sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Dow and S&P at new records, while GDP down 1%. ECB is in focus, and we have a great guest, Frank Curzio from Stansberry Research. All this and much more on episode number 366 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello and welcome. This is Andrew Horowitz, and this is the Disciplined Investor Podcast. We're beginning June here, and we're going to have a really great session with Frank Curzio. As a matter of fact, we're going to spend most of our time today talking with Frank Curzio, talking about some stocks, talking about some things that he knows about. I have a list of about 7 or 8 questions and the things that I really need to find out more about. So let's get right to it. And now, without further ado, our good friend, that fabulous, intelligent, good-looking, suave, and debonair man, Frank Curzio. What's going on, dude?
Keep going. That wasn't enough.
Well, I have more adjectives to describe you than you can imagine.
Yeah, I get yelled at by everybody else, so keep going. People say good things about me. I'm happy.
Yeah, well, you should be, because you're a great guy, man. You're just lovable, adorable, I mean, and smart. In one big, just great, juicy package.
Awesome. That's good.
I have so much to talk to you about and so many different questions. I know that you do a lot of focus on small caps. Obviously, from Stansberry Research, you are the small cap man. But I do know that you also have a depth of knowledge on things like large caps. I sent you that orange book from Bloomberg, right, which gives us all the different commentary from the various CEOs on their management calls, et cetera, and their earnings calls. I know that you enjoy that and looking through the depths of, you know, what's going on. But one of the things I thought we would start out with is just first we'll go broad base in terms of what's going on. Then I want to really focus it down to things like some of the deals that are going on in the market. Okay?
That's perfect.
All right. So we saw a GDP print this week of a whopping negative 1%, which is about 0.5% lower than expectations. A lot of discussion about inventories really being drawn down and problems there and all that. And then at the same time, markets didn't have a care in the world about it. Is that more so about the fact that this is a buying spree going on? Is it something in the future, or is it something that I missed?
I think it's a lagging indicator. That's why the markets really didn't get hit too much. We knew that weather was a factor. And weather, we say weather, you know, again, I hate when companies mention weather, but we did have significant restrictions when it comes to weather. I mean, there was people, you couldn't really go. New York was the worst winter in history. In Dallas, they shut down oil wells for 3 months. Weather really, really impacted businesses where, you know, people did not go out and buy things. And I think a lot of that is going to be made up next quarter, which says, you know, everybody's ignoring this number and saying, oh, you know, it's a lagging indicator. I know that means next number better be really good. Or if it's not good, we could see a little bit of a correction in the stock market. But that's the way the market's perceiving this. Like, it's a lagging indicator. The last 3 months were bad. We understand it. It's okay. We didn't think it was that bad, but we understand. And we have to face the facts. Again, when I listen to people and they blame weather, I think of it as an excuse, but this winter is a little different, and people were not shopping. People were not really buying things like cars and stuff like that. There was a big difference out there in the weather, in the history, and one of the worst winters ever. So, you know, they're going to get away with that print now. Let's see what happens next quarter. And what I'm hearing from the CEOs from this quarter is business is really, really strong right now from the conference calls that I listen to, the infrastructure calls, the oil services calls. I mean, everybody said business has really bounced back incredibly. Even the oil companies themselves said that business is bouncing back in a lot of the retailers. So let's see if that's translate into a higher print next quarter.
Yeah, because we did see a little bit of a concern from many of the smaller retailers, clearly, you know, even some of the bigger ones, by the way, that there was some outward concern. And that was, of course, in the end of last quarter when they were, you know, giving their conference calls. Clearly pockets of strength in various places. But, you know, at the same time, like, did you see that Michael Kors came out with their numbers on, I think it was Thursday or Wednesday of last week? Do you see their numbers?
Yeah, I mean, they're just eating Coach's lunch, and they're destroying Coach right now. And Coach is a good brand and everything, but Michael Kors, it's almost like them against Coach, and they're just taking everything.
Yep.
That, you know, it's like they're their big brother, just take everything from them. But, you know, like you said with the retailers, it's almost like until they fight back, and Coach hasn't found a way to fight back right now. So that's why I use that analogy. But You're looking at retailers. What I like right now is you're seeing pockets of strength, and some of them, Tiffany's pretty good, and other ones that have been doing terrible, and which is good as a stock picker because it allows you to pick good ones and bad ones. Where you know you got to realize the smaller names don't have those balance sheets where they could buy back stock, mask what's really going on, and you know increase their dividend and stuff like that. So you really have to look around the retail markets. Again, you'll be able to pick some up at a discount because the last couple of months have been bad and it's just starting to turn now because of the weather. But be careful with the smaller cap retailers that don't have good balance sheets. They can't really buy back stock when things are bad or if the market comes down. They don't have that much cash on the books. They'll have more trouble than a TJ Maxx and stuff like that and the Costco's or the Walmart's and stuff like that people love and that pay dividends. And those are going to hold up pretty well, I think.
You know, it's interesting. I was in New York a couple of weeks back, and I was driving down Madison Avenue going somewhere, and I was just looking at all the different stores, you know, Midtown, and obviously very high-end, right? And I counted in about a period of, I'll call it 15 blocks, okay? I counted 4 Michael Kors stores. I'm like, that's like the Starbucks phenomena, isn't it? You know, where you got, I remember I was somewhere in Starbucks. I was at one Starbucks and across the street, there was another Starbucks. How does a store, and I'm serious about this because I really don't understand this. How does a store, and obviously they do, but how do they get away with that much rent exposure in Manhattan, for example, on Madison with 4 different stores? Where's the smarts in that?
It could be smart if you think about it. Again, we're talking about New York, so you got to throw everything out the window. But every 2-block radius can mean another 5 million people walking past your store.
Right,
so,
yeah.
I mean, you've seen it in the Fifth Avenue. So, I mean, if you have a store 5 blocks away, seriously, it may not be a bad idea. I mean, even how much the rents are. And plus, you have a lot of Europeans coming to New York. I lived in New York all my life, and I moved out of New York. Because it's just, one, I don't need to be there. The job I took now at Stansbury, they allow me to work anywhere, and I went to Florida. And basically have, you know, figuring everything out with property taxes. It's almost like a 25% raise just simply for changing my address. Now, you say, then why would anyone live in New York? Well, a lot of foreigners are coming into New York now from Europe, and they're getting that raise because of currency. So you're seeing, you know, New York is just a different place. It's the capital of the world. I travel the world everywhere I go, and everyone's like, New York City, New York City. Everybody wants to live in New York City for some reason. I have no idea why. I just don't get it because you don't get what you pay for in New York City. I know I've lived there all my life. So, you know, in Queens, New York, and Brooklyn, and Long Island, and been to the city millions of times. But it's good. If you could open up business there, so you can own houses there, those things never depreciate in value, homes there. So I know friends that have real estate that are multimillionaires. Again, it's the king of the world. So when people say, well, how does that work in New York? It just works in New York. I wouldn't take that strategy and put it anyplace else.
I have a theory. I just thought of something as you were saying this. Here's the deal. You walk into the Michael Kors store, you and your wife, let's say you walk in and you know, you're shaking your head going, whoa, that's expensive for a bag, right? You say, you get those cheap ones that look exactly the same over at Walmart for like $10. This is, you know, $280, $300. You walk out of the store. You keep walking. By the time you get to the third store, you're broken down. Your wife's, I love that bag. I love that bag. All right, fine. So maybe by the third store, you're broken down so much, you're just going to buy it. Maybe that's a theory on why you have them so.
Maybe that works. But yeah. I will tell you this. When you're looking at Michael Kors, it's probably going to get more business. Because when you get Michael Kors, one, it's the hottest brand in the world right now. And two, it's not crazy expensive, especially for Fifth Avenue. We have Louis Vuitton, which probably sells bags 3 to 4 times more. So they're more expensive than Coach. You feel like you're getting a better brand. Again, they're all made from the same material, so it's all about brand. I mean, the bag costs the same thing no matter who makes it. It's just the name of the bag. So you have Louis Vuitton, who, you know, is like the king, and then you have Michael Kors, and you're like, wow, I could be really cool. I don't have to be like this ritzy, you know, at buying a Louis Vuitton and worry about getting stolen as soon as I walk out of the store. And then you have, you know, the Coaches. So I think everyone's going, you know, wow, I can get a good brand. So I think it's a good sale on Fifth Avenue where you feel like you're buying something with quality and it's not too cheap. And I think that's such a negative to Coach now because I think Coach is seen like just a regular brand. When I remember, my wife has Coach bags, but Coach was like, wow, you got a new Coach bag? People are like, now they look at Coach, they say, oh, you know, you got
a Coach.
Well, it's so different, right? Oh. When you happen to see a brand, you're in a lot of trouble.
Right.
Again, all this material costs the same, and it's all the name on the bag, and Coach is in big trouble right now.
I think we should have the Curzio Horowitz bag, you know, like the CH line or something like that, you know, price
really
it under.
We'd sell it to about four people.
Yeah, exactly. By the way, just as a point about Michael Kors, they did beat very nicely on both revenue and on EPS, and the outlook was raised ever so slightly. But the one kink in all of that was their margins. They did see some compression in margins. The big selling was the smaller bags, and maybe possibly there was something going on there. That's why the stock initially shot up about 6% on after hours, came down the next day to only about 1% up during the regular hours, down 5% the following day, although there was a lot of sell-side analysts coming out and saying, don't worry, and it popped up 3% the following day. The next question I have is a little bit more about the trading environment. I've seen several stocks recently get imploded after earnings. Mm-hmm. You know, a stock like I saw, for example, Ascena. Ascena comes down after the earnings about 8%. It goes up the next day 8%. There's a few different companies that this has happened to. We saw, for example, Aeropostale just absolutely get crushed. Came back about, I think it was down 20-something percent. Came back like 15 or 16% the following day. What is going on with that? Is it just so much that, hey, you know what? Let everybody just shake this thing out. And even if it's not at a support point or anything significant, just because it's down, I'm going to buy it?
Yeah, it's interesting because even companies that are beating, I'm seeing, especially in small caps, that are beating their estimates are coming down. I've sold off like 7-8%, you know? So it's kind of interesting when I look at it. I don't know what it is, and I can't really explain it, but I know from a technical point of view, it's very difficult to read anything because, you know, you've seen these whipsaws in one day. You know, you'll see them come down, and the next day they'll pop higher. For investors out there listening to this, just, you know, if it's a good quarter, you'll know margins are good. They beat on the bottom, top line. You know, most of these companies that are declined are the companies that have risen up incredibly into that quarter, and you'll see like a 5 to 7% pullback. If the quarter is good and everything's good, stay with it or maybe buy a little bit more. I think it's a good buying opportunity. But I am seeing the same thing. It's interesting where, you know, you're just seeing these sell-offs where I think people are just nervous out there. They're really nervous. You have, I mean, you interviewed a ton of people. I interviewed a ton of people in the past 2 years. I would say about 50% of my guests, and I interview someone every week, have predicted like a major decline of 25 to 30%, and they've been so wrong.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's not, it's, you know, they've had the stats to back it up and the printing and, you know, too much printing and we're expensive and this and that, but they've been so wrong. And you have to realize the media loves these people who say that the market's going to correct 50%, and it scares the hell out of everybody. So I think people are really walking on eggshells, and when they have these promises, like, let me take them back. And then when you see the companies pull back, maybe you're seeing a lot of the smart money say, no, these are good companies here. Let's get in here on this 5-7% pullback. Maybe that's it. But I know even from talking to people and talking to especially retirees, they're like, Frank, you know, I want to put my money in the market. I'm a little nervous. And that tells me that every time we see a pullback, as long as we have low interest rates, it seems like there's more and more people that want to put their money into stocks.
And what's interesting is that the interest rates, which I think is mind-boggling for many, have backed up dramatically over the last 3 months. I mean, we saw a rise in the 10-year through the end of 2013 and into 14, and then all of a sudden we're back to 250 and change on the 10-year. And what's really fascinating is it's on better economic news in some parts. It's on a rising stock market for the most part. And more to the point, it's on a Fed that clearly has been saying that they're going to be pulling back on their buying from $85 billion in the past to $45 billion now, and then going down by the end of the year and potentially raising interest rates into 2015 or 2016, and bonds are just being bought. That is not a correlation that you usually see that can be at all looked at as normal, right?
Nobody got that right.
Right.
So if anyone tells you they got that right, well, you're going to see interest rates come down. Nobody got that right. Everybody said rates going to go higher. I'm even refinancing my house because I think they've come down to the level where it's just worth it for me from a 30-year to a 15-year. I don't know. You know, it's just hard to explain, but it shows you that money is going into bonds and stuff like that. Some people think that, well, that may be a good sign for the economy, but I think it just shows that there is cash on the sidelines and people are just looking to put it someplace and they hate keeping it in the bank for such a long time. And now you're hearing a lot of stories out there that, hey, you know what? The economy is getting better. And it's not just people are saying it. I think people are seeing it. Because if you talk to the real estate agents, again, in Florida, I mean, they're running out of inventory to sell around where I am. And again, it's Florida near Ground Zero where everything was terrible. I'm looking at the malls. They're more crowded than ever. I think people see this. I think you know, people's home values are rising, so they feel like they have more money. And I think they want to do something to just leave their money in cash. I think it's a big sentiment factor. Sentiment's a big deal. When you feel like the economy is doing better, you want to put your money into more things. You're going to buy more stuff. And I think maybe that's what's happening, especially with, you know, there's no way you could explain why interest rates are going low here. I just can't see it. But it's kind of amazing. Again, a lot of people think that's a good sign of the economy. I don't know if I agree with that, but maybe that's it.
It is an odd sign. I mean, you have the same situation going with correlations broken. For example, the dollar coming down, gold coming down. You know, there's a variety of different things that are really breaking in terms of traditional correlations. One of the things could be and the consistency of the world central banks doing what they do. I know this is far-fetched and this is a little bit maybe or maybe not far-fetched, but, you know, I've constantly wondered if there are these sovereign wealth funds, which are adjuncts of governments, right, with money to spend, if they're actively, if they're the ones that are actively with essentially unlimited funds going out and purchasing stocks. You know, I'm not going to say the Fed's buying stocks and all, but what about the sovereign wealth fund of you know, South Korea or of, you know, pick your poison of any area around the world? Maybe they're the ones that are coming in and buying all this.
Well, let me ask you this question, even for the people that are out there. If you're South Korea and you have the $300 billion-plus fund or whatever, where would you put your money?
Right, exactly.
You know, into U.S. stocks in a heartbeat. I mean, we have a government that said, hey, we're keeping interest rates low for the next 2 years. We don't care. And you're looking at companies like Cisco, IBM, and Intel, which are really not doing good and are trading great only because they pay dividends and they're buying back stock. I thought Cisco's quarter was bad. Everyone's like, oh, Cisco came back. They're good. The stock went up like 6, 7% after the quarter. I mean, they wouldn't have beat the quarter unless they bought back their shares, and they did. I mean, still they're seeing switchers and routers. I mean, they're getting crushed, and, you know, that's why they keep mentioning Internet of Everything like 16 times.
I know.
It's going to be years before they benefit from that because they're such a huge company, and that is a big trend, but they're still their main business, even Intel. Intel is a PC company still. They're not even close to tablets. Yet you're seeing these companies, I mean, people throw money into them, and I've gotten them wrong because I'm like, wow, Intel's such a bad company. I'd rather own Apple. I mean, just, you know, IBM, too, is just how are they going to $100 billion in revenue? There's no way they're going to get that number. That's what they're generating over the past 12 months. And sure enough, they missed the number, and the stocks go higher. So,
well, IBM's interesting because I've been fetching and complaining and just absolutely pulling my hair out about IBM for about a year and a half now, saying, hey, you know what? The only reason that IBM is actually keeping pace in terms of the stock and EPS is due to share buybacks. They were like the original, hey, we're just going to issue dividends and shrink the float on our stock and sell off parts of the company. And finally, the recognition in Bloomberg Businessweek front page cover story last week with an umbrella over the head of the CEO with rain coming down saying, hey, wait a minute, how are they getting to this point? Because revenues have been coming down. Their earnings actually are coming down, but still, they have gone out and purchased so much of the shares back that one day you wonder if it's going to either go private or it's going to really be, you know, 100 shares trading. And then where's the share price go because EPS moves up? Let's talk a little bit about that. Let's talk about the whole concept of low interest rates, share buybacks, dividends, either initial dividends or rising dividends or even keeping dividends the same on stocks. I mean, because right now you can find on the large cap stocks out there 2, 3, 4% all over the place in terms of yield. I mean, 10 years ago, that would not be, you would have never heard of that. Apple pays a dividend right now. Microsoft pays a dividend. You would not have seen that. What does that say, and what's the analysis there?
Well, the analysis is that they understand the market. They understand that interest rates are low. They want people to buy their stocks, so they want to increase their dividend. That's why you're seeing the Microsofts, the Apples pay these yields. You know, that was unattractive 10 years ago, and interest rates are much, much higher. So, you know, in a low interest rate environment, people want to put their money. And we're talking about not like the individual investors' little thing. I mean, we're talking about, you know, the big money that needs interest, that needs the income. I mean, that's a massive market, huge market where people are dying for income right now. So it's no surprise that, you know, when companies announce, well, we're raising our dividend, they go up. It doesn't even matter what they do for the quarter. But, you know, getting back to IBM, I've been talking about this for a long time, and I've looked at the company, I looked at the numbers. I had no idea how they get to their numbers. I'm not saying they do anything crazy, and I wouldn't call them out because I have a spotlight on myself. But even two years ago, I was like, I have no idea about IBM. I went on my podcast and said, I'm not saying they're doing anything illegal. I'm just saying that I have no idea how they come with their numbers. And, you know, they're losing market share in their businesses. They're talking about big data. And just to put it in perspective, you know, here's a company that does $98 billion in revenue. The big data market is said to be about $20 billion, and they're a big play. But even if they took that whole entire market, which they won't, I mean, it's still, you know, in order to make a dent, they're going to have to take that whole market. So that's why even the Internet of Everything for Cisco, when you're such a big company like this, Yeah, I just, I've been warning people at IBM, and the company has pulled back and everything, but I'm still surprised it's in the 180s. I mean, I think it should be 150s with IBM. I just think that they're losing market share. But going back to your dividend point, that's the theme. We see low interest rates. They're going to be low, guys, for a very, very long time. Forget anything you hear out there. You're looking at least 2 more years of low interest rate environments. It's just really good for stocks out there and really good for the markets. It's really good for the economy. I don't think the Fed's going to touch them, especially since they're looking at the CPI, which is, 1.6%, a little bit on the high end. But they said as long as it's below 2%, we're going to keep interest rates low. They're not expecting over 2% inflation until 2017. So I'll give you a little perspective of how long interest rates could stay at these levels for at least the next couple of years.
Now, let me give you a little stat that I just pulled up, okay? If you look at the S&P 500 since 2000, just 2000, we're talking about round number 13 years plus, okay, the average price change, the price change on the S&P 500, just the value of the price, has increased 28%, okay? 28% raw number on the S&P 500. When you take dividends and add it back, you have to add back, and now you get 67%.
Mm-hmm.
You got a 40% increase in your return from the dividends over the 13 years.
No surprise, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that tells you right there. The actual return on an average annualized basis is the difference between, 1.8 to 3.8, and you go from, $100 invested from $417 up to $982 if you have the dividends invested. So, I mean, the power of the dividends is substantial. And as we see that we're seeing dividends increasing or dividends applied to the S&P 500 stocks, obviously that's a gigantic component. In fact, it's so large, it's overwhelming the fact that that is the major component of the return. But to get back to the idea of buybacks and IBM, take me through why the buybacks will continue and investors won't care about the fact that it's only buybacks that increase the buybacks that increase the EPS, and there's nothing concerned about, hey, you know what, that's all that's happening and revenues are reducing and all that. I mean, is that good?
You know what? If you're looking at an earnings basis, it's not bad because companies are still able to cut costs. We're seeing, you talked about this a lot, that the birth of technology and robotics and stuff like that, where you're seeing, they're taking over jobs, where you're able to cut your expenses even more now. And as long as these companies, a big number to look at is the cash flow. As long as they're generating cash flow, IBM's generating cash flow, Cisco's generating cash flow, Intel's generating cash flow, they're going to take a lot of that money and buy back their stock. They're going to increase their dividend, continue to do so. The thing that I worry about here is you're seeing them continue to buy back stock, but here's where the trend can get into a little bit of trouble. The stock market's at a 52-week high now.
Mm-hmm. So it's an all-time high. Wait a minute. It's an all-time high.
Exactly. Do you really want to buy your – I mean, should we be buying back our – I love the fact they're buying it back 2 years ago, even 1 year ago, right? I mean, we've seen a major move in the markets. It's still up like 17% over the past 12 months, around there, or maybe a little bit less. But right now is now the time for some of these companies. Yeah, I mean, they're trading higher, but if you look at it, they're still trading at 12, 13 times earnings, like the Halliburton, Schlumberger, the oil services companies. If you look at them, they're near their all-time highs, but these companies are still cheap. That's fine. But if you're looking at, the Intels, you may say they're cheap, but they're kind of expensive based on where they've been trading over the past couple of years. I don't know if I want these guys to be buying bad stocks at this level, but it also puts a floor on it if the stock does come down 10, 15% too. So there's two ways you could look at it. So will they continue to do this? Absolutely. Of course they're going to do this. I mean, it's a major component of earnings. It's the only reason why Cisco beat their earnings. Nobody talked about it. Everyone's like, wow, Cisco beat their earnings and the stock jumped. But if they didn't buy back stock, they probably wouldn't have beat their earnings. So I think it's going to continue as long as they generate cash flow.
And we'll see how this can trade. The S&P is now trading at about 17.5 times trailing, and I think it's close to about something like 16 times forward, I guess, something like that right now, right? And the Dow has a little bit more room to go. The NASDAQ trading about 34. Let's go and talk about China for a second. Let's kind of zip over to another part of the world. There has been a lot of concern about the fact that the property, something we've talked about for a while, this real problem with the shadow banking. We're seeing that there is a record amount of bad debt and bad loans and late payments and all that happening there. Some calls by players like a Gary Schilling to say, hey, you know what, there's going to be a major implosion there, what to do. And at the same time, China government has been trying their best to slow down inflation, slow down the borrowing. They did things like they're changing the one-child rule. They're actually, last week, they changed the reserve requirements. They let their currency actually start coming down. It was riding up forever. And it really came down very strong recently to enhance their exports. What do you see is happening with China? Because there's also a backdrop of questionable accounting, particularly in those stocks that trade in the U.S., and a question as to really what is the actual situation in China.
I could tell you that everything that you just said was the same exact story a year ago.
Right.
I mean, nothing new. So for me, it seems like the short sellers have been shorting that market or trying to get that word out there because, let's face it, I mean, you take the FXI, which is kind of the benchmark for us over here at the ETF for the China large caps. They've been really trending higher over the past couple months. So you're seeing that come back. You're seeing a lot of emerging markets come back. India is starting to do fantastic. Again, it totally tells me something that's not new in India. Again, we've been talking about this for like at least 2 years, how the property market's going to explode and, you know, inflation is higher. But I will tell you this, that it seems like they're getting inflation under control. When inflation's high, they can't announce stimulus packages.
Mm-hmm.
Now that inflation, and it's not under control by any measures, but it is better than it was last year, that people are anticipating, and that's why I think you're seeing the China market move up here. They're anticipating that they're going to come out and announce major stimulus packages, you know, throughout the different industries. So, you know, the real estate market, it's so difficult to tell. You know, I talked to a lot of different people in the area, and a lot of people agree that, you know, the accounting is crazy. They're trying to get better. I mean, if you look what happened, they actually put, like, didn't they put like 100 people within a family behind jail recently? I mean, I read a story. I thought it was a really good story. Not that all of them went to jail, but basically it was a guy high up in government. They own a bunch of different properties that he's given to his family, all this stuff. They have different, they were able to invest all, you know, all because of this guy's position. And they basically arrested him. And you're talking about, you know, everyone was looking at that going, was this a political move or is China really trying to clean up their act? Because doesn't everybody listening to this wish China would clean up their act? I mean, there's no question they're going to be the biggest economy in the world. There's no question every major company in America wants to invest in China and open up their shops there because there's just so many people there. It's such a great economy that some, you know, that I've been in, that I wish there was no corruption, because you don't need corruption for that place to grow and be a monster. So I'm hoping and praying that they do clean it up. They probably won't for another decade, but it was interesting to see a high profile figure get arrested and all of his family members. I'm telling you, dozens and dozens of people. It's a pretty cool story. It's everywhere if you Google it. I've read it like a month ago, but they said how this guy was just, you know, getting feedback and kickbacks and stuff like that, and they were just able to invest in so many different industries. And, you know, like their kids who were young had like huge stakes in these, you know, oil and gas wells and stuff like that, and they arrested everybody and said, hey, this is all, you know, all you guys going to jail. So I'm hoping they clean it up. But, you know, going back to the original question, is I don't see anything different that you're telling me from the last year, so I don't know if I'd use that as a catalyst to sell shares. I know that China market going up, the trend looks pretty good right now. If they announce a stimulus plan, it's probably going to go higher.
Well, let me ask you this, because, again, I agree with you. I don't think there is really anything per se new. And I do think also that what happens is if there is nothing new, oftentimes things will float until you see some major directional change of either a government initiative, cracking down on the graft issues, cracking down on the fact that the largest grouping of billionaires in China is all, you know, all in government. But you take like a guy like Jim Chanos, well-renowned short seller. And I have a question, and this boggles my mind. You have a markets that, generally speaking, in the U.S., clearly, that just keep going up. And you have China not really cracking and all that. How does a guy like him, who is dedicated short, make money?
I really believe, and I'll say this, and I know so many investors, and we were fortunate to interview him. I think Chanos is man, the top three smartest guys in the world.
Yeah,
that guy is brilliant. There's a lot that goes behind his short sell. So it's not just him shorting China and getting killed. Because if you look at, say, if you're shorting a company like so many people shorted Green Mountain Coffee, right?
Oh, did you have to talk about that short? Not that short.
Sorry.
Not that short.
Let's talk about Einhorn. When he made the presentation, he said, oh, you know, there's accounting problems. And it really wasn't accounting problems. He was like, I talked to a guy who got – and I was at this presentation, and I love Einhorn. But he said, I talked to a guy who got fired who said, you know, this and that about the accounting. And I was like, wow, that's not really a good source. You know, so I was like, but anybody who has a short position always mentions accounting. You see that all the time. It was just mentioned in a Seek and Alpha post on iRobot. And I don't like iRobot. I went to the Consumer Electronics Show and saw seven companies have the same exact products as them. And I was like, wow, you know, what happened to that patent portfolio? Everyone has those vacuum cleaners that roam around the ground by themselves and stuff like that. And sure enough, a guy came out and said this whole thing about iRobot and then mentioned, and I think the accounting's bad. So that's a short sell to say. With Jim Chanos, it's, yeah, and going back to Green Mountain Coffee is, you know, you have such a huge short position on it and you see that short ratio go up that when you're wrong, Coca-Cola does a deal with them, you get wiped out because it goes up so much. With Chanos, he has a lot of hedges in place where he can keep these things. And I don't know how he does it, and maybe, you know, currency hedges or whatever, but he's able to keep, because another company, GameStop, he was short for a very long time and got crushed on it. Now GameStop has come down finally, but for the past like 2-3 years, I think he was short GameStop. But with China, there's a lot of different things in place where it allows him to keep his short in position, even if he's wrong for a little while. Otherwise, you'll get whipsawed out of it. So I'm trying to understand it. It's very, very complicated. It's a whole use of options and strategies and currencies and stuff. But he's an absolute genius. But that's how he's able. It's not just, hey, let me short Green Mountain Coffee, because if you're wrong, the thing goes the wrong way and you get blown out. A lot of this is covered. They're leveraging themselves here, and I know Chanos does that. So when you look at, say, okay, he's been, you know, short China for such a long time, and maybe you could say, you know, he hasn't really done well with that short or that great with that short. He's done okay. But the reason why he's able to stay in that trade is because he has hedges in place to allow him to do that. So I think that's the question you're asking, right?
Yeah, and it's different than an individual who's looking at a stock and looking at either the technicals or looking at the fundamentals. For example, you take a clear example, and probably one of the most recent and well-known short side of things was Herbalife, right? So Herbalife is being ganged up on, the stock gets crushed, and then they finally start coming down. Lot less discussion about it. Soros comes into it and buys it, and a variety of other players are in there, and I think Icon was, which, by the way, this weekend, interesting story about Icon being investigated for some kind of insider deal with Phil Mickelson. I don't know if you saw that yet. But somebody giving some information away, whatever. And full disclosure, we actually just initiated a short on Herbalife. It actually was on our buy list for a long time and then came off due to a variety of different fundamentals. But it would seem to me that you know, Herbalife, although the company has the potential to really put up a pretty good fight in terms of the you know, buying of their own shares and maybe even going private one day at all, I mean, you look at an Herbalife, and it really does have a lot of questions about what's going on there. Finally, in the world side, and then I want to get to some individual stocks, the ECB next week. On Thursday, the ECB is supposedly coming out with some kind of something. Now, there was some discussion about, well, maybe they're going to do some kind of a bond purchase program similar to a quantitative easing. I've always said that's going to be very difficult for them politically as well as just technically. I mean, you know, you have all these different countries involved there. Now they're talking about potentially we're going to see a rate cut and maybe even negative deposit rates. And I'm fascinated about this negative deposit rate issue, Frank, because, by the way, Frank at Stansberry Research has some great newsletters and all. You can get some freebies over at Stansberry. We'll have all that information on the notes and of the episode on thedisciplinedinvestor.com where you can get that. But what are your thoughts on this negative interest rate situation in terms of deposit rate where banks would essentially have to pay money for money that is on deposit with the Fed or the central bank in Europe? And, you know, it's an experiment that's never been done, but will it actually push money out? And will banks be like, okay, enough, we can't do this because it's going to hurt us and we're going to have to lend it out and take risk?
Yeah, and that's what they want to encourage them to lend it out right now, which is very important. And I think everybody knows, everybody's figuring that you know, Europe is going to come out with some kind of stimulus package, and they need to, and they have to, and, you know, you're going to see a lot of news on this next week. But, yeah, they want to encourage lending. Even you're looking at U.S. banks, too. I mean, people don't realize how strong the U.S. banks are. I mean, these are a monster. They're 10 times stronger than before everyone said they were too big to fail. You're looking at U.S. banks. When they had the stress test, it was for a 50% decline in the market and a 25% decline in home prices, I think. Which we didn't even see in 2008, which was, you know, a crazy event that we only saw two times in the last 80 years. So this is how much cash they have. And, you know, you're looking at even banks elsewhere. I mean, in order to grow that economy, you want to be able to lend. You want to be able to lend, you know, be smart when you lend. And you want to encourage that as much as possible. And that's what they're trying to do there. So we'll see if it works. We know that Europe has been a lagger. You know, I mean, they hit their credit crisis after us. So a lot of areas are having trouble coming out of it. You're seeing them come out of it a little bit better. I mean, when's the last time you heard about, Greece or Portugal or the pigs and stuff like that? Remember, that was such big news like a year, 2 years ago. We're not even hearing anything about that, right? Greece could collapse the market. It's so horrible. We're not really hearing those stories there. So, which means that things went from terrible to less bad. So it's going to be interesting to see what they do and see how this project works, but definitely expect a lot of news next week and more, at least initiation of stimulus plans out of Europe.
Well, what's interesting is that this is fascinating. Since where we've been and the fact that Mario Draghi put some things down, a year and a half ago about, hey, we're going to do everything and anything we can do to save things, blah, blah, blah. And we saw that Italian yields and Portugal, the yields on their bonds and Greece. Do you know that those markets are hitting basically all-time lows in terms of yield or close to it in terms of their bonds?
Mm-hmm.
Are you aware of that?
No, I wasn't aware of that, no.
All-time lows. I mean, that's kind of a shocker, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. It's just, it's going to be interesting. Like the next, I mean, you hear Art Cashin talking about it, everybody talking about it. I mean, that's the big news next week, what's going to happen in Europe. It is going to be interesting to see what takes place there and how it influences the market. Look, there's so much money out there, especially in the U.S., that wants to invest in different areas. And I feel like Europe's getting the short end of the stick here. But it is going to be interesting to see what actually takes place. And again, guys, if you're looking for places to buy, areas to buy, I mean, pay attention to what's going to go on next week. You're going to see a lot of news.
Yeah, I mean, I will say on the negative side, one thing that you do see P.E. ratios in Europe overall, and their indices are pretty hot. I mean, the Euro Stock 500 index at 21.5, although they have about a 3.5% yield, where the S&P yields about 2%. But nonetheless, Thursday is going to be interesting. It's either going to be one of these things that there's going to be so much incredible amounts of stimulus they put in that, wow, you can't resist, or it's going to be a massive, massive sell the news kind of situation. Let's talk about shale. You've talked about this. Last time we had you on was back in January. You were big on this whole shale thing. I mean, some of the companies have really done incredibly well, even with natural gas coming down. It's come down a bit. You see that oil has been hovering above 100 for some time now, and coal stocks still are not at all doing anything of substance. It's kind of like everybody forgot about coal, I think, the whole idea of it, and just kind of let it just linger there. But what's the story in terms of the shale plays? And we had a lot of issues with the fracking, and then it came back, and then all of a sudden it became a very profitable enterprise. What's your take on that now?
When people say shale, you should think of shale oil, not shale gas. I mean, there's not too many people drilling for natural gas right now because natural gas is a byproduct of oil. We have easily over 100-year supply of natural gas. I would say more like a 200-year supply of natural gas. And if natural gas goes higher, you're going to see a ton of this come online within weeks. And we haven't even really drilled deep when it comes to natural gas. We're starting to drill deeper when it comes to oil in the Klein Shale and stuff like that. But it's just an incredible industry. Just to show you, there's so many stories out there. I think Zero Hedge posted something. And I know Zero Hedge, and I read their stuff, and they're good. They said like the end of the shale boom, they pointed to California, which isn't really a shale place at all. But they said how the government lowered their estimates and, sharply, and showing how, I get one guy in a podcast saying, that the estimate is citing government estimates, and the government has been so wrong on shale. I mean, just look at the LNG facilities. They were all import terminals, and now we're going to be exporting LNG, the largest exporter of natural gas in the world. So, you look at statistics and everything, but for someone who's been in the field, it's just incredible the new technology you're seeing. If you think the shale boom oil is over, look at Harold Hamm. He's the CEO of Continental Resources. His stock went from like 20 to 1 whatever, 135, 140. Here's a guy that just bought $6 million worth of his stock at $135 a share. And he is the CEO of Continental Resources. They're the largest land player, a largest player in the Bakken. That's a place that I visited. I mean, he's buying his stock at $135 a share. So here's a guy that's probably the smartest guy in the oil business, in the shale oil business, who's buying his stock at its all-time high, thinking like we're not even close. So if you think the shale boom's over, I think you're nuts. This has come from someone who's been in the industry. I have no stake in anything, just in stocks that I recommend. I think fracking is a super safe technology. We're getting better. It needs to be monitored, of course. So, you want, from environmental concerns, of course it does. But it's just interesting when you look at fracking, because it's a game changer for the U.S. I mean, by next year, we're going to become the largest oil producer in the world. Think about that. That's nuts when you say that, right? There's no way the U.S. That's a fact. So that's going to happen in the next year or two. And that's a great statistic. Now, we have the chance to open up fracking everywhere, but only 45% of people believe fracking is safe still. I mean, they'll read these crazy stories. They'll watch Gasland, which has nothing to do with fracking at all, where the guy turns on the faucet and stuff like that and then is able to get methane and burn it, and has nothing to do with fracking. But there's just – and there's a reason why it's not translating into Florida and New York opening up their borders, is because people are scared of it still. Now, to put that in perspective, 60% of people believe that marijuana should be legalized for recreational use. 60%. So if you want a major trend, go into marijuana, because not only does the people want it, which means the government's going to follow, because they're like, wow, you know, our constituents want it. And if they want it, look what's happening in Colorado. Look at some of those numbers. They're like quadruple tax revenue already, much higher than estimates than they previously thought, and they just approved it and started selling it this year. Washington approved it. Again, 60% of people want it, so the politicians are going to approve it because they love those tax dollars. And more important, doctors are coming out one by one in the marijuana industry, like Sanjay Gupta, who was asked to be the Surgeon General, who turned it down, said, listen, I'm 100% wrong, and I apologize. Marijuana is okay for you. But just to compare that to fracking, where if you get the people to believe that fracking's okay, you'll see states open up. Right now, politicians vote according to their constituents. They don't even care what's right or what's wrong, because they want to keep their job. Most people still believe fracking is not safe. In the meantime, you got places like Texas, North Dakota. The states are absolutely booming. You're talking about small towns that I visited. Andrew, it gives me chills when I go to these areas. You see these kids working hard. They're making good money. They're spending the economy. You know, you see them dirty from working so hard, man. And it's a great American story. It's a great American story. And how people don't want this to take place, and they're shutting down New York.
Let me tell you this. I have a chart in front of me that I just pulled up on the North Dakota, the Bakken oil production from 2008 to the current. Okay. It is from the bottom left to the top right. In 2008, you were pretty much at about 50,000 barrels a day, okay?
We're at a million now.
We're at just about a million.
Yeah.
And there was a little bit of a blip, a little bit of a...
Harold Hamm thinks it's going to 2 million.
Wow.
That's the estimate. Yeah, I mean, the estimate's out there like for 1.5. He thinks 2 a day, guys. 2 million a day in the Bakken.
Here's what's interesting. So if we do have much more legalized marijuana and for recreational use, and a lot more people are smoking it, and the government then follows along and kind of expands that, what will happen is we'll have a lot more people mellow, and maybe they'll be like, dude, all right, so fracking's not so bad. I like it now.
maybe.
You know, think of it that way.
Yeah, you could. And I just want, you know, because we always throw numbers out there. I want to put the 2 million barrels in perspective to people. If North Carolina was a country, they'd rank like 17th in terms of oil production. So if they were able to produce 2 million barrels a day. And that's just North Dakota. So think about the shale area in New York and what we could do if we opened that up. But people are scared. I mean, the guy came out with a good move with Gasland. He came out with Gasland 2 because Gasland 1 didn't make sense. So he said, oh, what causes earthquakes? Guys, how many earthquakes have we – we've drilled tens of thousands of wells in fracking. Again, I'm not this huge pro-fracker guy. This is someone who was skeptical going in that visited all these areas. I spent tons of time. I drove through the entire Eagle Ford through 20 counties, guys, at 900 miles. And just saw this with my own eyes and talked to the people. And I'm telling you, it needs to be monitored, of course. Of course it does need to be monitored, just like every other.
So give me some stocks there. I mean, you mentioned
Continental's one of them that I really like here. You look at it.
Give me the stock and the symbols.
Where is it? Hold on. Let me see if I can provide this list for you, because I have a list of stocks that I like. Okay, so you got – let's start with Continental. Continental is CLR. Then you're looking at Pioneer is one of the biggest players in the industry. That's PXD. Pioneer is a great play on the Permian Basin. You're looking at EOG, which a lot of people don't know. EOG is part of Enron. Did you know that?
Enron is still around. Still floating around. Yeah.
EOG was like the source of – that was the one part of Enron that survived. But EOG Resources, those are the three big guys that I love. And here's why I like them. They're the three major shale players in the world. They're all located in the main areas of the world, whether it's the Cline Shale. Pioneer is more Cline. Eagle Ford is more Pioneer. And you have
Continental in the Bakken.
In the Bakken. So you got those three. But this is the reason why I like them so much. The big oil companies completely missed the shale oil boom. I have no idea why. They're the best research teams. They completely missed it. if you look at the reserve replacement ratios for some of these companies, they're having they're struggling replacing reserves. It doesn't mean they're running out of oil, but they're having trouble finding oil that's economical. That's why I've predicted for the last year and a half oil prices are going to stay above $100. And a lot of people have been saying it's going to go to $60. It's going to continue to be higher because oil is getting more hard to find in every place else in the world except for the U.S. And you're looking at the reserve replacement ratios falling under 100%, which is the barometer. That's bad.
Right.
But most of the state-owned companies, which are much bigger than ExxonMobil is in terms of production. So you're looking at these three companies. They're growing their production by 20, 30% when the rest of the world is having trouble growing their production. Okay. So you're looking at these companies and say, well, you know, EOG Resources have the $57 billion market cap, and that's the biggest of the three. But you know what? These companies, you look at Exxon, they're spending $40 billion a year to find oil. I mean, Chevron, $25 billion. You're looking at $723 billion being spent this year by international oil companies to find new oil, and they're having trouble finding it. Yet, you're looking at these three companies right here. I mean, I think they're all three of them are takeout opportunities. It just makes so much sense. Instead of spending a ton of money on these major projects, why don't you buy one of these three companies that are seeing huge production growth? So those are three I like. It just makes sense that they're really not too expensive here. And then you got, again, Harold Hamm buying his stock at Continental is all-time high. And then you got companies like Laredo Petroleum, which is a major player in the climb I love. I mean, they're in a prime spot. You want to invest. If you're investing in these industries, don't go in and say, wow, these guys are in the Eagle Ford. Because the Eagle Ford, like I said earlier, is a lot of different counties. The lower half is natural gas. And if you have an area in that, it's not good because natural gas prices are low. But in higher area, that's where it's oil rich. And there's certain counties in there that we visited where if you have oil in those areas, it's fantastic. And Laredo has oil in the Permian in the main prime spots, and they could drill up to 900-plus wells. They've saw blockbuster results so far, and I think it's at a great price. I mean, we bought it cheaper than this. It went up to 30 and it pulled back, but I really like Laredo as a mid-cap, small-cap player.
And what's the symbol? Let's show everybody what symbol Laredo is.
LPI.
Okay, let's kind of just shimmy right over out of the oil, out of the economics of the world, out of what's happening with the ECB and all that. Let's talk about two particular deals that you and I have talked about. First, I want you to talk about the AT&T deal and what your take is on that.
I think AT&T is doing a great job. I think it's a great deal for them. I said on my podcast about a year and a half ago that my favorite large cap stock is DirecTV, and I've never got so much heat for it from subscribers.
And I can see why. I mean, I can see...
You know? Yeah, and right away, you know, when I see that much heat, I'm like, yes, I'm right. You know, people are like, Frank, that's a great pick. I'm like, shit, I'm dead. You know? But with the AT&T deal, I think people understand that they're like, well, it's a saturated market for DirecTV. It really isn't. If you're looking at the U.S. market, right, the whole market's kind of saturated, right? I mean, everybody has a cell phone. Everyone has an internet connection. You know, everyone has TV. Now, you're looking at TV. Let's go with AT&T and Verizon, right? Let's go with those wireless providers. The biggest deal in how they make money is, since everyone has a cell phone, is by raising prices. Well, AT&T and Verizon can't really raise prices anymore because how many deals do we see out there are like $50 for the month, no contract, unlimited texting? I mean, we're seeing that everywhere. So you're looking at AT&T and you're looking at Verizon, they're having a lot of trouble growing. I mean, they were stealing subscribers away from each other, away from Sprint, T-Mobile, and stuff like that. But now they're at a point where there's so much competition out there, they can't raise prices. The cable companies have been raising prices incredibly.
Yep.
I mean, Time Warner's and stuff. I mean, four times the rate of inflation over the last 10 years. It's unbelievable. And even those guys, now you have the Netflix. So those guys are having trouble raising prices now because you got the Netflix, the Amazon's coming in. And then you have the DirecTVs where they're going through an upgrade cycle with their equipment. Everyone's going upgrading to the Genies. I'm a DirecTV subscriber. It's fantastic. You could tape more. And they charge you, like, you know, for the first box is free, and then they charge you a couple bucks. But they're making money on that. They have Latin exposure where they're growing. They could take away subscribers from the Dish, which is not really that good of a company. I mean, they don't have as many high definitions. So this is a company that's able to raise their prices still. They're a cash flow generator, monster cash flow generator for AT&T. I think the synergies are going to be great. I don't know why they're making such a big deal about the NFL package now, because if I was AT&T, if the NFL package was a big deal, which it is, it's a huge deal, DirecTV, why not purchase them after they sign that deal next year?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I don't know why they waited now, but I think that deal is going to be a blockbuster for AT&T. It's going to allow them to pay that 5% yield for a long time, based on the cash flow being generated by DirecTV. I think AT&T, it's a great deal for. I think DirecTV at $90, $95, I think it's a fantastic deal for them, too, at that price. I'd be a seller of DirecTV. But I think that's a great deal, and that's why you got Netflix CEO time. They're coming out. They hate it because they know it's going to be significant for AT&T. It's going to generate a huge cash flow. They're going to be able to pay that.
What I don't understand is, I mean, just help me with one thing on the technology, okay? So you're watching an NFL game, and you're doing your thing, whatever you're doing, you're watching, and it starts downpouring. You got problems with your reception, right?
You have problems with, when you have storms, especially in Florida. I've had the package probably for 5 years, and I've never missed a game because of that. So, I mean, how often does it rain? Is it a pain in the neck? Yeah, it could be. Yeah, if you have a really bad storm, sometimes it freezes up, and it does freeze up, and it could be annoying. But it's seriously, it's. I mean, being a client for 4 years, I've never had a football game freeze up because maybe it just doesn't rain on Sundays here or something.
Oh, maybe. That's possible. Very nice. The gods are the football gods. Real quick, though, you mentioned so AT&T is a good deal. Did you say you're a seller of DirecTV?
I'd be a seller of DirecTV up here. I mean, I told people to buy it in the 50s. So I said it was my favorite watch.
And what's interesting, it's come down after all this has been announced. It's come down from whatever, let's see, let's call it 88 to 85.
Yeah, well, you have limited upside, basically, because you're talking about, what, 90, 95 they're looking to buy it at. So, you know, I think, like, right now would be a good selling point. And even when they announced the deal, it was a good selling point, I said. So, you know, now it's coming down a little bit. They're definitely going to sign the NFL
but
deal.
But you'd be a buyer of AT&T?
I'd be a buyer of AT&T. Even if they don't do this deal, people are viewing it as negative, so the stock's probably going to go up. And even if they get the deal, I'd take a half position here because maybe the stock comes down a little bit. But I think it's going to – I mean, look, they're going to have those satellite connections up there where you're talking about in-flight connectivity for airplanes as
well. Which is really interesting, by the way, because that really blew out Gogo.
And that's one of the things I want to talk to you about, too, if you want to get into Gogo. That's fine.
Yeah, let's talk about Gogo because I thought it was really interesting. Gogo, you know, it's there and it's got its thing going on. A lot of planes are, you know – wired with it right now. Some fleets are really going after this pretty strong. It's a good moneymaker for both the airlines and Gogo. AT&T comes out with an announcement, hey, you know, sometime in the future, they didn't really put a date on it per se, they didn't have it really there, they're going to come out with a in-flight package for airlines. And I thought that was really interesting. Gogo just got absolutely obliterated on that news and then started climbing back up a little bit. What's the story?
We were fortunate. I mean, we bought on that pullback. The stock came down originally like 30% Gogo from like 34 to wherever. And then the AT&T move came in. And the reason why the move came down, they came lower because it was kind of momentum stock. And, you know, over the past couple of months, all momentum things got smoked. So, and then the AT&T news came out and it fell again. And I actually put it on our newsletter like $13-14. Because I analyzed the news. It was so funny. AT&T came out and said, you know, because Gogo has an 80% market share in in-flight connectivity. I love it. I use the service. It's great. I can actually work on airplanes now. But when AT&T said, we're going to come out with a better service, 4G, this and that, nobody really looked at the news. They just said, holy cow, AT&T, they're a cash cow. Gogo's dead. Gogo has all their clients signed up for 10-year contracts that are going to last to 2018. So AT&T can't touch any of their contracts till 2018. I've never in my life seen a company decline 35% from a competitor entering the industry that won't be able to touch them for how many years? So 2018.
Yeah, but does that also mean that there's not going to be any growth? I mean, you're not going to get any potentially new contracts being signed are not going to be done.
They're going to be done. First of all, AT&T is not going to be able to enter this industry at all until 2015, 2016, they said, which is a couple more years. The technology that's taking place, even over the past 5 months, because I use this service, is amazing. Think AOL dial-up compared to today. I mean, technology changes so rapidly that they're improving it. They're starting to do text and call services, so you're able to text in flight now, which is, you know, that's going to increase subscribers. The technology from now until 2016 until AT&T enters a market are going to be night and day. It's getting better by the month for Gogo. They're signing more contracts. And the huge deal here, the growth component here, is the international market, which AT&T can't really touch because they're basically a domestic company. And they're starting to sign a lot of international clients.
Because a lot of times you can't get international. Well, definitely not over water.
Yeah, well, that's why you need satellite connections and stuff like that. So it's going to be even interesting if AT&T does get that deal with DirecTV.
Right, exactly.
But which is another component. But for now, everything is so long-term and so out there. When you look at Gogo, I mean, insiders are buying the stock like crazy, $13, $14. And I was like, wow, okay, here it is. I can't believe that no one's going to be able to touch this technology. And AT&T may not even be looking for in-flight stuff. They announced that before DirecTV, before all that stuff went down. So, and they have their plate full. They're going to be going to court for a long time. People fighting this, thinking the deal shouldn't get done. And that was one of the things I want to talk to you about today with the small cap world. You're seeing so many opportunities open up because people just run to the exits on bad news, and we're up like 30% on GoGo in 2 weeks. You know, you see that a lot in small caps, and we've benefited a lot just being able to pick up stocks that get smoked on news. But if you really go into the news and you analyze the news, is AT&T going to be a competitor? Could they be? Absolutely. That's a risk. But the fact that they're not going to lose a dollar until 2018 tells me the stock shouldn't be down 60% off its highs over the past 4 months.
Well, actually, I'll tell you something, Frank, real quick. I mean, think about it, really. The triumvirate would be for AT&T to get DirecTV and to then buy GoGo.
Yeah, and go and
that would be the play.
And Barron's actually came out, and they have a lot of and even AT&T has to buy the spectrum in this space. And, you know, it's not easy to buy spectrum, especially when you're AT&T. We are already one of the largest owners of spectrum, which GoGo already went through all these regulations already. Right. So if you're looking at the regulatory hurdles as well, there's so much that has to happen for AT&T to even enter this market in 2016. And there's so much that has to happen for these guys to go to AT&T in 2018 and not GoGo, where GoGo has a four-year window to really do everything to build a relationship. It's almost like I'm managing money. You're managing my money, Andrew, for the next 4 years, and then you have BlackRock's going to come in. They get to talk to me. What are you going to do over the next 4 years? You know, you're going to be taking me to dinner. You're going to be hanging out with me. You're going to tell me how great your services are. You build a relationship over that time. Nothing illegal. But you're building a relationship over that time, and then, you know, BlackRock's going to come in. I'm going to be like, you know, Andrew's a good guy. I've been with this guy for a long time. These guys are good. So the fact the stock's down 65% off of this news, maybe it should have declined 20% in total, but 65% was just too much, and we're up a lot in the stock. I like GoGo.
Are you telling me that you heard that BlackRock may be buying us? Because this is something I need to know.
It's probably a bad example. But
Man.
I think people got the point.
Okay. Last question. We're going a little bit long, but I need to ask you one more thing on a deal. The Apple Beats deal, which was pre-announced at $3.2 billion, came in at $3 billion this week, just a billion over the price of the Clippers. But what is the story with this in terms of the fit? Because it's kind of interesting. It's the biggest deal that Apple's ever done. They haven't done a deal even remotely like this for years and years and years and years. It mixes up a couple of things. First of all, you get some hardware, of course, the headphones and that whole selection of things related to music. And you get a very small but yet somewhat growing streaming music system for that. How does this all fit?
I think it's a fantastic buy. And I saw the Wall Street Journal come out and nail these guys for it, and heard a street column saying, you know, this is not the Steve Jobs way. Well, you know what? This is a lot bigger company now today. You know, it was a little bit bigger with Steve Jobs when it was at 700. But they're finding difficulty in growing Apple. Now, if you want to grow Apple, you have to go to the acquisition market. And this is where I disagree with Icahn and Einhorn, who is saying you should use that $100 billion plus in cash and buy back stock. When you buy back stock and you initiate a dividend, your multiple is 10 to 12 because you're saying, okay, no, we're throwing the growth towel. Okay, so Apple's no longer a growth company. They're a value play. When you're a value play, you get the Microsoft multiple. When you're a growth play, you get a 15, 16, 17 multiple. In order for them to be a growth play, they have to go into the acquisition market. People are like, this is a bad move. They have over $100 billion in cash. If this deal totally goes to nothing, you know what it does to Apple? Nothing. It's not a big deal. So I think I love the fact that, hey, it's a big deal for the market. It's not a big deal for Apple, who's the largest company in the world, $500 billion market cap, over 100.
Are they largest now?
I think they are the largest.
Wow.
So, you know, you're looking at Apple. So I love the fact. I mean, just to consider how big Apple is, they could take over Las Vegas Sands and Wynn Resorts with the amount of cash after they bought them at their current market caps and be the biggest gaming company on the planet. Mm. So they could do so many different things right now. They could be the number one player in any single industry they want to. They're not going to do that by starting from scratch. They got to do it through the acquisition market by purchasing the big guys who have been in this market already. They have the cash to do it. They can get into any market they want to. I think that's the key. If I'm an Apple shareholder, I love the fact that they're going into the acquisition market instead of just buying back their stock. You know, I just think that the multiple is going to be 10 or 12. You're going to see the stock trade in a trading range. If you want to jump over 700, 800, and go to 1,000 one day, you got to have that growth component. The only way they're going to do it is through acquisitions.
Okay, but let's focus on this acquisition. I mean, what are they getting out of this?
You know what's amazing? I mean, people looking at the streaming side of the business, I'm looking at the hardware side of the business. I could never believe that Apple, being the largest music provider in the world, had the worst headphones in the world. You know what I mean?
Yeah, they weren't even headphones. They were just things they stuck in there.
Yeah, and more important is, and this is something that we do at SNA, we're very, very good at marketing. We know how to market things. So we actually market some other newsletters or joint partnerships, And I think they're going to bring Beats to another level where they can't be. Let's face it, Apple is the greatest marketing company on the planet. So I think they're going to be able to market Beats. And I don't think Beats, you know, when I went to Consumer Electronics Show, there was, I'm not kidding, about 70 headphone companies out there. And some of them were better. You know, you just don't know about them. So they don't have the greatest technology. But I think you're going to see them absolutely everywhere. And every single one of Apple's products now, it's going to be fantastic. Instead of getting those crappy headphones. So, you know.
So how are they going to put that gigantic headphone in that little iPhone box?
It's not gigantic headphones, because I don't have those gigantic headphones.
You're talking about the little ones.
The earbuds, which are $99, which are fantastic. I mean, the bass and everything, I use them all the time. So they could put those in there as well. It's not getting the big headphones, but of course they'll be able to sell those big headphones, which are red hot right now, right? I go on a plane, that's all I see is people with these Beats headphones on. So, you know, I think it's very early in that trend. I don't think you have to worry as much as competition when you have Apple's marketing behind you now. So I think it's a fantastic acquisition. I think they'll easily make their money back. And even if they don't, I just love the fact that they're acquiring companies now, because that's, as an Apple, you know, if you're an Apple shareholder, you want to see them acquiring companies. That's the way they get back to their growth model.
Well, they also did this right before the WWDC, the Worldwide Developer Conference, which starts Monday in the afternoon coming up. And there's some speculation on what they're going to talk about, what there's going to be a watch, some home automation. I mean, home automation has been this concept, the golden ring, the brass ring that has been discussed for so many years. Microsoft started the trend, never went anywhere. Obviously, Google bought Nest, which you even see those in Home Depot now and all, and they obviously can, push. I mean, I wish I had one of those, because every time I push the temperature down in the night, I get out of bed, and I'm, what are you doing? You're putting the temperature down? No. You know, you got to sneak it. So I could do it right from my iPhone, just kind of like push it down a couple degrees, because my house, I don't know about your house, but my wife likes it like 77. I'm thinking 77, that's like a blast furnace.
Yeah, it is.
You know, I mean, it's a blast. And you put it down a couple degrees and your air conditioning bill goes up ridiculous amounts. But all right, so the Apple Beats, you like the Apple Beats, you like the AT&T deal, sell DirecTV, GoGo you like, and Shale. Well, that's a lot from Frank Curzio, I must say. And thanks for being with us so long today. You can check out all of Frank's information over at Stansberry Research. He has just an amazing array of information in terms of his newsletters. Also, the podcast that you do over there. You've been doing it for a long time. You know, this is podcast episode number 366 of our show. You know how long that is, Frank, with only like 1 or 2 weeks that I missed in all that time? It's like 7 years.
Yeah. If you count the street, I'm up there with you. You've been doing it before me, definitely longer than me. I think I started 6 months after you at the street and then continued here. But yeah, long time, man.
Well, that's one of the reasons that BlackRock is looking at us.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they just want the technology and the stuff that we do here from the production side of things. So.
Yeah, I told them.
Anyway, listen, I don't know if you saw the Heat game last night, the blowout. That was just an amazing game. I mean, you know, kind of LeBron James, I think, is stuffing it to all those naysayers that he's, you know, he's going to be the problem on the team, but go Heat into the finals. And I know you're a basketball fan, and I wish you well in terms of your back. Your family is doing well, I know, growing up and doing great. So, Frank, I will see you soon, and thanks for joining us.
No problem, man. Anytime.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Take care.
And that's it. We wind up this episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast with all about the monster market with Frank Curzio over at Stansberry Research. Thanks for joining me. Any questions you have, you could just write to me over at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Or if you want, of course, just go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Click on all the links that are there that will give you all the information about what we talked about, the stocks that we talked about, etc., on this show and much more. Thanks for joining me. See you again next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented that should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.